You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and hundreds of cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Well, the situation at the Bundy Ranch continues, and I wanted to check back in with Sheriff Richard Mack. We had him on the program last week, and just get his thoughts on the update. It seems like there was a pretty long and strong piece, a couple of them actually, on MSNBC, basically suggesting that Sean Hannity was playing with fire. And then Hannity came back yesterday and attacked John Stewart, saying, "No, I'm not playing with fire. I'm telling everybody, you know, just take his hand, take his house by judicial process, but keep the guns away." And it seems like there's like an effort to calm this thing down. But Sheriff Mack has been on the ground there. Sheriff Mack, M-A-C-K.com is his website. Sheriff Mack, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Tom. Wait, this isn't working because I'm just hearing a total echo of myself.
Okay, I think we just got rid of that.
Oh, way to go. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey.
Good.
Modern technology.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I should say you're a former Arizona sheriff in Graham County, and you're on the board of directors of the Oath Keepers movement, oathkeepers.org.
Yeah.
So what's your take on what the status of the situation is right now, sir?
Well, the bottom line is I've got a new hero. And his name's Sean Hannity. I really am totally on Sean's side. I think he's done a terrific job on all of this. The other news media outlets have not addressed some of the real key underlying legal issues here involved. This is not the first time. That's going to be a good pun, huh? This is not our first rodeo.
Yeah.
This is not the first roundup of cattle in Nevada. This is the 53rd rancher that the government has tried to run out of business.
Well, the BLM has had this authority since the 30s. So
yeah.
I would guess that it's been done a lot of times.
And a lot of this goes into the specifics of water rights that were inherited by the Bundy family way back in the early part of the 20th century. And
I'm sure you're familiar with the story now. It's been reported by all the major news media that Bundy's dad bought that ranch in 1948. There was no 1877. They bought that. They moved from Arizona to where this ranch is in 1948 and bought it from I forget the name of the family.
And I was told 1877, and I've actually seen that reported. Maybe
it's wrong.
Maybe they were in ranching since 1877, somewhere.
I think he was only 2 years old when his father bought the farm, so bought the ranch, and only bought, by the way, the water rights to the ranch. Had no contract with BLM until 1957.
Right.
And so he may, he was just a little kid.
Well,
he may just be misremembering things. That's easy to have happen.
Right, okay. There's other court precedents. One is the Dan sisters, who are Native American. The federal government ran them out of business.
Right.
And then there's the Hage case. And the Hage case is huge on this particular incident with the Bundys.
Yeah. Well, I thought the Dan sisters actually probably had a stronger claim because, they were Native American.
Correct. They did.
You're right.
They did. But they're still gone.
Yeah. They are. They are.
And the Bundys literally... This part is also, this statistic is true. There were 53 ranchers in Clark County.
Right.
Now, Las Vegas isn't the only calling card for Clark County. There's lots of other industry there, and ranching used to be one of them. But they're all gone. And this is because the federal government has found ways to finagle people out of business. And if Mr. Bundy had signed the most recent contract with the federal government, because of the water rights issue involved and what you have to do to qualify to keep your water rights, it would have disqualified the Bundys from keeping their ranch.
Right. He would have had to dial back radically on the number of cattle on that land.
Correct.
Because there's been a drought going on there for 4 years.
Correct.
And that kind of land just can't sustain the number of cattle that he's been illegally grazing on it. And so the BLM's coming in saying, hey, it's our job to manage this land, and you're ruining it.
Yeah. And
So, I mean, this is really an issue of a drought, isn't it, as much as anything else?
Well, I don't believe that premise that the BLM is in charge of the land, and I don't believe the premise that the ranchers are hurting the land. Ranchers help the land. And I can show you statistic after statistic how that is true. The only thing they say is, well, he should be paying his fees just like all the other ranchers in the country do.
Yeah.
Well, you could argue till the cows come home that ranchers help the land, and they do. And, you know, you want to help the land, put a rancher or farmer on it. But at the same time, this is as something as Americana as a ranch that goes back way before the foundation.
Well, to some extent, that this Americana, I mean, it seems to me that what we're looking at here is more of a culture war than anything else.
You could be right.
And are you familiar
with?
I
want to get into the Hage case.
Yeah. Well, for just a second, if we could set the stuff aside. I don't disagree with you on. Well, in any case. Are you familiar with OccupyOurHomes.org?
No, I don't think I am.
Okay, let me just put a bug in your ear here, if I may.
Okay.
This is a group, they're active all over the United States. One of their more active groups is in Atlanta. But basically what they do is they go in and stop, or try to stop, government officials from evicting people from their homes when the banks have basically robbed them of their property.
Okay.
And I'm looking at this one story, a disabled Desert Storm veteran of Avondale Estates, Georgia, needs help to save his home. It's over at OccupyOurHomes.org. And they've got dozens of these things, and people are showing up. And good people, and this is not a right or left-wing thing. In fact, one of these Occupy things, you had a whole bunch of guys who showed up with AR-15s.
Right.
It seems to me that rather than one or even 53 ranchers who the BLM is pushing off their land because of drought or whatever, because of turtles, because, you know, Harry Reid's son wants to build a solar panel, I don't give a damn. 53 of these guys. We've got 3 or 4 million Americans who have lost their homes because of crimes committed by banksters on Wall Street who own body and soul, both the Republican and Democratic Party and the elected officials. These guys are getting multi-million-dollar bonuses. They go before Congress and lie. They come into D.C. and they're treated like royalty.
Right.
And it seems to me like if you want to generate a patriotic movement that is totally independent of party and totally independent of whether it's Fox News or a liberal show like mine,
right,
that showing up with creating your own version of OccupyOurHomes.org,
right,
showing up and saying, you know, it's a crime that these banksters got bailed out to the tune of trillions of dollars, and these homeowners are screwed.
I'm totally with you on that. I totally agree. And, in fact, the organization that I founded has addressed that twice at our national conventions.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually helped people fight the banksters on their foreclosures. And, in fact, if you look it up on the Internet, Sheriff Tom Dart from Chicago, from Cook County, was probably the first sheriff in America to stop these foreclosures. He would not serve the foreclosure notices. He refused.
Yeah.
He told the banks, I'm not going to do it.
You know,
the banks, you know, Sheriff Dart was not fired. He was not put in jail. He did exactly what we ask sheriffs all across the country to do. Stand up for the little guy in your county against Big Brother government, against Big Brother banksters, and against this kind of wholesale sweeping of removing people out of their home.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, if your movement was to include some people in cities, some people of color, some people who've been screwed by the banks as badly as the BLM, and just say, you know, we're all being screwed by these people.
Yeah.
I think that
I'm with you.
You know,
we do.
Both of us could move a little forward on this thing.
Our sheriff of the year was Sheriff David A. Clark Jr. from Milwaukee. He's a black man.
Good on you. So Sheriff Richard Mack, his website, sheriffmack.com.
And CSPOA.org. CSPOA.org.
CSPOA?
Yes.
Okay, .org. Thank you. Hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And oathkeepers.org, too. Sheriff Mack, thanks a lot for being with us today. Good talking. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. The Medicaid red state donut hole is killing folks.
Yeah, and it looks like there are even fewer and fewer reasons for Republicans to continue their solely political opposition to this. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities has taken a new look at a report that came out last week from the Congressional Budget Office, and it turns out that Medicaid expansion is a lot better deal for states. The federal government's going to cover now over 95% of Medicaid expansion costs for the next 10 years. And the cost of expanding Medicaid are only going up 1.6% for states compared to if under health reform compared to if there was no health reform. So this really is a financial win for states, and it's what needs to be done. But we still have Republicans across America that are just continuing to play politics with people's lives.
Yeah, and it's a sad thing. And that's of course going to be the setup for our Lone Liberal Rumble. Kevin Martin and Andrew Kloster are going to drop by.
Yeah, it should be a good rumble. That'll be the first topic we get into. We'll also talk about a new study by economists over at Princeton. They've released new facts that really say what you've been saying for a long time. America is not a democracy anymore. It's an oligarchy, and only the rich and only the wealthy have a say in our government. They looked at a variety of pieces of legislation and policies that were considered over the past 20 years or so. And it turns out that if wealthy individuals supported that legislation, lawmakers acted. But if just working-class Americans built some sort of support or opposition for it, nothing happened. And it really goes to show that if you have money, you're the ones that lawmakers in Washington care about. And it's really a terrible thing.
Yeah, it really is. Other topics?
We'll also be talking about how Americans' middle class is no longer the richest in the world. That feat has been taken over by our neighbors to the north in Canada. Pretty startling. We'll also be touching on 1 in 5 American children are going hungry every day, and we'll lead out of that with a new study that shows that poverty leads to shorter lives. While the rich are getting richer, they're also living longer, but everyone else is living a lot less. So it's an interesting topic to get into.
Yeah. And?
And then we'll finish out the rumble with legislation out of California that is trying to tie corporate tax rates to the CEO to worker pay ratio. If you have a lower ratio, then you would theoretically pay less in corporate tax. But if you have a higher ratio, somewhere along the lines of the 345-1 that it is today, you would be paying a higher corporate tax rate.
Sounds like a good plan. That's sort of a variation on my suggestion that we should tie the minimum wage to congressional salaries.
Right.
You know, if the minimum wage is $11, it would be 8-1, according to one of my callers yesterday. If we just fix it at 8-1 from now on, okay, Congress, you want to raise your pay? Raise everybody's pay.
Right.
Anyhow, so then Cowboys and Indians ride into D.C. It's amazing. Louise and I were coming in this morning, and we went right by a whole bunch of teepees.
Yeah, there's a protest going on right now right on the National Mall. A group of ranchers, farmers, and Native Americans from across the country are protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. They're going to be camped out on the mall all week, obviously getting the attention of D.C. Goers and tourists and lawmakers right on Capitol Hill. And it'll be interesting to see what effect their protest has on the Keystone debate.
Yeah, it definitely will. And Portugal, a new model for socialism.
Yep, we'll be getting into a discussion about Portugal, what's going on there, and really, is their economic model the future of socialism and possibly for the U.S. and around the world?
Fascinating stuff. Andrew Campbell. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you tonight at 7. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you. It's really interesting. It's like at some level, you set aside all the inflammatory rhetoric, which can be damn hard to do at times, tragically. But at some level, I think that we're all interested in the same thing, which is a country that works for everybody. Now, when I say we all, I mean, you know, Sheriff Mack, middle-class guy. I think I'm a middle-class guy, relatively speaking. Most of the people I know and work with are middle-class. You know, I don't know anybody who's a, well, I know a few billionaires, actually, multimillionaires. But the point is that the group that is screwing us all is not, it's not Clive and Bundy. It's not the Oath Keepers. It's not Sheriff Mack. It's not me. It's not the liberals. It's frankly not the BLM. In fact, I mean, if it's true that the BLM is moving these ranchers off this land because the tortoise habitat is endangered, and the tortoise habitat is endangered because of drought, it could be that the villain here is ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers causing global warming. Now, it may be that Sheriff Mack watches enough Fox News that he doesn't believe in global warming, but I think there's 99% of scientists do. I mean, but I think that there's still this broad consensus in America that it ain't working right now. And we saw this report yesterday. I was talking about this at some length yesterday, that Canada now has a richer middle class than the United States. In November of 1986, I spent the month of November of 1986 living in Beijing, China. I lived in the Beijing International Acupuncture Teaching Hospital, and they had a dormitory attached to the hospital. And this is one of the ways that China was making a little money on the side. It was a very poor country at the time. And for 200 and something, my recollection is it was $236 a month. We got room, board, plus one-on-one translator and a one-on-one doctor. And every morning we would study acupuncture meridians and poke needles in oranges and things in practice. And every afternoon we'd go out on the wards and the doctors would show us where to needle the patients. So there's a 500-bed hospital. And we'd stick needles in people. And my roommates, there were four of us in the room that I was staying in. My roommates, a fellow by the name of Pablo, who's still a good friend. Last time I saw Pablo was just a year ago in New York City. We had lunch together. He's a psychiatrist now at Bellevue. And Pablo's from Colombia. He was a Colombian. And our other two roommates I've lost touch with, haven't talked to them in years, but they were both Japanese. One was a physician and one was a massage therapist. And basically China was like, you know, hey, if you're interested, they had a 2-week course, a 1-month course, a 6-month course, and a 2-year course. And the 2-year course was for people who are serious about learning acupuncture, and the shorter courses were for people who want to know enough about it so that they know something about it. You know, I had no intention of ever practicing acupuncture in my life. I just wanted to learn it. And you know, we were between, we had sold a business in 86 and we were living in Germany, and I had this, and I had to be in the Philippines later that month, and it was on the way, and it was $236 for a month. And so and Louise was like, fine, have fun. And so I went and I studied acupuncture for a month. And I'm living in Beijing. This was just a couple of years before the Tiananmen Square thing, you know. And it was November. It was cold. And in the middle of every street, there were these piles of coal briquettes. And people would heat one room in their house. And the tallest building in the entire city of Beijing was the Hilton Hotel, which was 10 stories high. And lunch at a local Chinese restaurant was 3 cents. And Pablo and I used to go out and we'd find, you know, new restaurants and things. And they were like in the back of people's houses. I mean, there was no commercial stuff. This was communism. The reason I'm telling you this story is I stood in Tiananmen Square standing in front of that giant highway, 8, 12, 14 lanes, whatever it was. And maybe once every 5 minutes, a car would go by. Giant black car with a government executive in it. All the rest of it was bicycles, an ocean of bicycles. China was poor. Recently, when I was in Germany last week, and I was reading the Financial Times, and there was an article about the Chinese middle class. The Chinese middle class is now larger than all of the United States. More than 350 million people in the Chinese middle class. Because they changed their trade policies, we changed our trade policies, and we basically moved all our manufacturing over there. Our middle class has collapsed, theirs has exploded. So we look at these I call them Reaganomics policies, but frankly, the Democrats were and still are up to their eyeballs in this kind of insane trade stuff. The president's in Japan right now trying to cut another one of these deals. This one, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA. He calls it the TPP. And I think Americans, Democrats, Republicans, right across the board, we're being screwed by the billionaires, by these transnational corporations. And it's time for us to wake up. And waking up does not mean showing up with a bunch of sniper rifles pointing at BLM guys. I get it. You know, you're upset. But please don't let the demagogues like that multimillionaire guy, Sean Hannity, convince you that some, you know, BLM guys, they just wanted to be cops when they grew up, who were doing something good for the environment. They're just protecting the land. That they're somehow the jackbooted thugs? When the banksters are throwing people out of their
You're
homes?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, we got a long way to go in this country and a lot of awakening to do. And I think step one is we need to stop yelling at each other and start talking with each other. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Ron in Denver, listen on AM 760. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Hey, I got a solution to this problem, if corporations are people.
Yeah.
As the Supreme Court has ruled, then Rupert Murdoch should be issued an arrest warrant for hyping up this mess out there in Nevada. And so should Sean Hannity.
Well, you know, they're just following the numbers. I mean, you know, they're Hannity is his TV show has been doing so poorly that, I mean, there's been talk about pulling it, and this is Sean Hannity's equivalent of, you know, Flight 370 over at CNN, or Chris Christie over at MSNBC. I mean, it's like. It's so funny. We get home and Louise is like, okay, which do you want to watch? Chris Christie, Bundy Ranch, or Flight 370? Because those are your choices. And I'm like, you know, let's just go to bed.
Hannity's there stirring up civil unrest, and that is a chargeable offense.
Well,
he's standing right alongside the man and even said something about gun himself.
Yeah, I know. I think he's dancing along a line, or has danced along a line that he got, I think he realizes he got too close to, and I think that that's one of the reasons why he went after John Stewart. Of course, you know, if John Stewart calls you out by name, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, you know, as P.T. Barnum said, I don't care what they say about me, just as long as they spell my name right. So John Stewart calls Hannity out by name. Hannity gets to call, you know, yell back at him. This helps the ratings of both of them. I mean, you know, I'd love it if John Stewart called me out by name, or Hannity, or anybody. Feel free, guys. You got to understand, at a certain level, this is the entertainment business, and or at least at that level, you know, I mean, Hannity had a $200 million contract. That's the entertainment business. Jon Stewart's making probably that kind of money. That's the entertainment business, and at that level, the politics is not what's right or what's wrong. It's what gets the most eyeballs for the advertisers. Am I making sense here?
And we got a lot of degenerates that watch Fox News.
Well, yeah, I'm not Fox News. I don't know if he said a word he shouldn't have said there. If he did, I just dumped it. Anyway, my apologies. Yeah, we're gonna side on side a question. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I did want to echo what you had said earlier in terms of the way in which the narrative has been crafted such that, you know, people want to believe, you know, the notion of this sort of legal axiom of post hoc, ergo proctor hoc, after, therefore, because of. So because America is changing in terms of its demographics, its browning, you know, because we've got an African-American president, because of, you know, the ascension of gay rights, and I can go on and on and on, that therefore this is because America is now this rather than what it used to be, and the middle class is in decline. Therefore, this is what causes the middle class to be in decline.
Right.
And this is the wondrous narrative that they've been able to sell to a lot of people out there who aren't very well informed.
Right, mixing correlation with causation. Let me just interject, Steve, and I'll turn it back to you. But just I found this was fascinating. This was in Science News, I think, a week or so ago, and it's one of those things I meant to talk about on the radio, never got around to. There was a study that was just published in the last couple of weeks. You can probably fairly easily find it now. And they took a group of white people and asked them basically a bunch of questions that elicited political perspectives. You know, were they progressive? Were they liberal? Were they conservative? You know, just a whole spectrum of things. And then they told half the group, or maybe it was all the group, I forget the methodology, but anyhow, then they told them, by the way, do you know that right now more people of color are being born in the United States than white people, and within a generation, America will be majority brown, no longer majority white? They simply told them that little fact, which is, you know, and not with any animus, not with any, oh, my God, not with any hair on fire. You know, let them discover it in some way that did not have emotion connected to it. I don't know, maybe it was in the newspaper that they handed to them to read 10 minutes while they came up with the next set of questions. Then they asked them another set of questions to determine, you know, their conservative or liberal bias. And what they found was that once those white people had been exposed to the browning of America as a fact, their political opinions became more conservative. And I think that, you know, your point, if this is your point, that an awful lot of what's being played to is the old Pat Buchanan thing of, you know, it ain't America anymore if it's not white and WASP. It's the song they're playing over at Fox News. Back
right,
to you.
Considering that Pat Buchanan was Catholic, it's somewhat ironic that, you know, that the notion of a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Yeah, other than the fact that now you got six Catholics on the Supreme Court. Yeah,
exactly. But, and also, you know, he never bothered to take into consideration that the notion of white is a fluid concept.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, for instance, Hispanics intermarry within two generations of coming to America, and they intermarry into the mainstream culture. So then, you know, you essentially, you know, down the road, when you survey persons who are partly Hispanic, and that was two generations ago, fairly few of them identify themselves as Hispanic.
Well, and the other thing that is fascinating to watch is the changing notions of beauty in our culture. This was another study. This was like 4 or 5 months ago I read this, where they were asking, and again, it was a study done on white people, and they were asking them, you know, identify the beautiful women in these pictures, or identify the attractive people, men and women in these pictures. And what they found was that people who had been exposed to movies that had, in particular Scandal, this is called the Scandal effect. I forget her name, the actress in Scandal, Kerry Washington. Thank you. Who's just this extraordinarily beautiful black woman who's having, you know, a love affair with a white president of the United States and other white guys. And it just kind of breaks down that whole, you know, all these notions that white people who had been exposed to interracial love scenes, for lack of a better phrase, were far more likely to identify attractive people of color as being attractive, as opposed to white people who had never been exposed to that kind of thing, who would pretty much say what was attractive was other white people. Even if by some standards they weren't. Am I making sense here? I'm garbling this.
And I like to interject.
And I think our standards in the United States of beauty are changing. I think it's a good and wonderful thing. Go back to you, Steve.
And I think you're right. I would interject that there is a generational distinction to be made.
Yes.
If you poll white people over the age of 60, you're going to get very different results than if you poll white people under the age of 35.
Well, that's because, you know, the formative years are, you know, 7 to 25 mostly.
Right, exactly. So you're going to find very different attitudes about same-sex marriage, interracial relationships, all these sorts of things, which is why, by the way, you'll notice that the GOP is not going to be running anything with regard to values voters. You know, except right. In specific areas.
Unless they start changing their tune. And this is why I think that there's actually a small possibility that Rand Paul could be the nominee and maybe even the president in 2016. And I realize that every political commentator in the world thinks I'm crazy, but I, you know, just hang on to your hat.
He could possibly get the nomination, but I doubt that he would win. But again, to your point with regard to, you know, the larger picture, America, again, has changed, and we're not actually living on the same planet in terms of a sort of a baseline from where we start in terms of asking, all right, what are the objective truths here? Because when you talk to people who are the Fox devotees or the right-wing talk radio listeners, and you say to them, well, you know, here is the science behind global warming. No. It's all a big lie, a giant conspiracy on the part of the best minds in the world to trick us all into some sort of socialist, you know, agenda and the giving up, you know, capitalism, blah, blah, blah. They are not even on the same planet, and you can't argue the science. You could demonstrate to them, this is the indisputable science.
Yeah.
No. It's a big lie. Okay. So tell me where the lie is. Where are the problems with the dependent and independent variables, intervening variables? Give me the science. Oh, I don't know, but I know I've been told that it's a lie.
Right.
Well, we're not even on the same planet, then. We can't begin a debate because you're not ready to accept science.
Well, and that's why in my conversation with Sheriff Mack, I'm saying let's start out with some foundational principles, which is we all agree we're being screwed. You think we're all being screwed by the BLM. You know, 53 ranchers are being screwed by the BLM. Maybe, maybe not. But I'll give you that. What about the 4 million people who are being thrown out of their homes by the banksters and the government power that's being used to support the banksters? Shouldn't we be doing something about that? And all of a sudden you get maybe that's a possibility. Steve, I want to get some more calls in here. Thank you so much for the call. Tim in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Tim, what's up?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
Good. I just wanted to take issue with the sheriff's description of the ranchers being such good stewards of the BLM land. You know, I've hunted in Idaho my whole life since I was 12 years old, and these cattle just trash the countryside, Tom.
Yeah, I've heard
they
that.
Just stomp the springs out and urinate in the creeks and defecate everywhere. They're really not that good of stewards of the land, Tom.
Yeah, my understanding is that the buffalo are actually pretty good at it because they're hoofed, you know, and they've got these sharp hoofs that break up the soil and act like plows, you know, and help it. But the cattle, because they got flat feet, just basically stamp everything down and kill it off. And
right.
It's like not.
Also, Tom, that's where the deer and elk live here in Idaho.
Yeah.
And once they release the cattle on the BLM ground, there's nothing left for these animals to graze on.
So then the deer and elk go, and people like yourself who have been hunters all your lives, you see it happening. Tim, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us, your perspective with us, and your experience, your life experience. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How do we get us all on the same page? Elizabeth Warren's page, really, that the big guys are screwing all of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike in Reno, Nevada. Nevada. Excuse me,
hi.
Mike. How you doing?
Yeah. Good.
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
I was going to ask you if you ever heard of the White Dragon Society.
It sounds vaguely familiar, but I can't pull anything up as it is a some variation on the KKK
well,
or something?
No, it's a consort. I don't know what you'd call it. It's these are very powerful families in Asia, and they're in numbers of countries, including Russia and India.
Uh-huh.
And what they're claiming is that the bankers of the world, which they refer to as the cabal, are bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
They are the actual creditors, the White Dragon Society and their allies. And what they propose, and they have allies in the Pentagon and CIA and other agencies who are in sympathy with them. You remember the run-up to the Syrian conflict where the president was threatening that we were going to have some altercation there, and then suddenly everything was pulled back because the Pentagon didn't want to go along with it.
Well, it wasn't just the Pentagon. The president couldn't get the rest of Europe to go along with it. President Putin came in and said, I'll take care of this. You know, I got this for you. I mean, a bunch of things didn't go right for Mr. Obama if he wanted to play George W.
Right.
Bush.
And behind that, the growing solidification, unification of this kind of attitude toward this warmongering is participated in by the White Dragons. It used to be very warmongering, you know, like 1,000 years ago or whatever.
Mm.
But now they say that they have a claim to like 85% of the world's wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones who encouraged the Great Leap Forward in China. They were disappointed with you know, some of the brutality of it, but they say they knew that they had to do something. And what they're proposing now is to use the wealth to make it really a trust to go out and end world poverty. People in the Pentagon say it could be done in 3 years, and also to reverse environmental destruction.
It's pretty,
it really
some pretty amazing
it the
stuff.
Kind of planet that we're supposed to have.
Yeah. It sounds to me like the kind of stuff that you read on the internet that is the hopeful musings of you know, somebody who's been reading too much Tolkien. But you know, if there is some truth to it, and the consequence of it is that it's a better world, then you know, I'd salute that flag.
Okay. Well, there's a reporter named Benjamin Fulford who claims to be their spokesman.
Yeah.
And that could be an internet thing like you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's also a guy named he's a lawyer, and there's actually a litigation going on to reclaim the wealth that's represented by bearer bonds, which for gold.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line here, Mike, is, you know, if these guys are interested in making a better world, let's see them make a better world. You know, I'd like to see some action. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Bruce in Richmond, Indiana. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thank you, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I definitely agree with you on the Reaganomics. Ronald Reagan really slammed the country big time, and I tell a lot of friends of mine, just listen to Billy Joe Allentown, and that'll explain a lot right there.
Okay. I don't know who that is, but... Oh, Billy Joel, the song Allentown. Yeah, okay, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
That's a lot about Reaganomics right there, sir.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that and Merle Haggard's Let's Put America First. And then what's that song? We Can't Make It Here Anymore. We Ain't Making It Here Anymore. It's an amazing song. That's in any case, back to you, Bruce.
Yes, sir. Just got two quick comments, please. I want to talk about the Keystone Pipeline real quick,
mm-hmm.
and how amazing it is that the Republicans are backing this project up tooth and nail, but yet they won't back up any projects for infrastructure repair.
Well, here's an even more bizarre one. The Keystone Pipeline will create around 3,500 jobs for a year or two building the pipeline, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 jobs. And then after that, you'll have 35 or 40 permanent jobs running that pipeline, okay? The passing long-term unemployment benefit extensions will give money immediately to over 2.5 million people who have been cut off since just after Christmas by the Republicans. And those people will go out and spend that money, and that will create at least 100,000 jobs instantly. So you give 2.5 million people, you know, a little bit of cash, you create at least 100,000. Some people say as much as 200,000 or 300,000 jobs. That has passed the Senate. John Boehner is the only man right now who is blocking that in the House of Representatives, because it will pass if he allows it to come up to a vote. And but John Boehner and Eric Cantor do not want that to come up for a vote. Unless you put Keystone on it. It's like, really? It's so sick and twisted. It is just
it's
so
amazing how Ross Perot was right with the giant sucking sound.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Ross Perot was right, Bruce. He absolutely was. Thanks a lot for the call. Dolores in Bryan, Ohio. Hey, Dolores, what's up? Dolores is listening to her TV. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom. like that attitude about, you know, if you're going to do something, then do it, you know.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Yeah, concerning the XL,
mm-hmm.
If the Cowboys and the Indians and the Sheriffs all want to get together and make a point about how to better this world, and the Cowboys and Indians going and talking to the people in Washington, D.C. about, you know, don't do the XL pipeline.
We're going to have them on the TV show tonight. We're going to get a cowboy and an Indian on. I mean, literally.
I'm just saying, what they need to do at the same time is say you need to end hemp prohibition and keep your thumb on Monsanto.
Yeah.
Because that's how all of this is being developed. You know, if farmers were growing hemp and people were allowed to grow their marijuana patches, I guarantee you the Petro wouldn't have the foothold it has.
Yeah.
The people would be employed, gainfully employed, by their own hard work.
Yeah, Bob, I know this is your own personal crusade and obsession, but and I agree, there's a lot of truth to it. So thanks for bringing it up again. Brooke in Sunbury, Ohio. Hey, Brooke, what's up?
Thank you for hearing me. I have a few points about the Keystone Pipeline that I'd like to make.
Go for it.
The argument that it creates jobs, I'd like to point out that if routing it around the aquifer would create more jobs and use consume more steel and more pipe, and there's no way that it should go across the aquifer. And if it does, it should be conditional approval.
Yeah. By the way, you know where we're buying that pipe from?
Canada, I guess.
China.
Or China, Chinese pipe, not good. Yep. Not job creating. I was a small businessman as an auctioneer for a while, and my state required me to have a surety bond.
Mm-hmm.
And that would cover people that I made damage. Now, let's say a person who's living in Nebraska, and they have a farm, and their farm is dependent on water that has no oil in it, no petroleum poisoning in it.
Right.
Why not force this company to buy insurance, this oil company from Canada, buy insurance to cover potential harm that they may do either to a person's property or to the aquifer in general?
Yeah.
And that policy would also apply to companies like BP.
That's a good question. You know, with the nuclear industry, of course, we had to pass the Price-Anderson Act to say literally that the U.S. taxpayers will be on the hook if a nuke plant goes down. But I don't know it may well be that TransCanada did have to buy some sort of liability insurance, maybe not as much as they need to. And I don't know if there's been some, you know, oil equivalent of Price-Anderson that immunizes the oil industry in some way. That's a good question to put to somebody who's a real expert in that field. I frankly am not, Brooke, but I'm going to have to look into it. Thanks for giving me a wake up on that. Ernest in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Ernest, got a minute till the end of the hour here. What's up?
I was living in northern New Mexico here since 1969, and it's all ranching country up here in Forest Service and BLM. And a lot of these people here do not have enough land of their own to raise cattle, so they graze on the Forest Service land.
Right.
Well, there's not enough water half the time for these cows, and so they completely overgraze the area. The ranchers tend to turn their cows out on the state's roads. It's a known joke up here. We call it roadside ranching.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, while some ranchers may be good for the land, what I've seen going on in northern New Mexico is far from that.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I didn't want to get into a global warming debate with Sheriff Mack, but everything that I'm seeing, you know, reading between the lines, as it were, is that what we're looking at is a drought problem. And when you look at a drought problem, a multi-year drought problem in the United States, you're looking at a global warming problem. Ernest, thanks a lot for the call. And so he, you know, if he really wants to be taking up his issues, he ought to be doing it with the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil. But, you know, time will tell. Anyhow, the climate deniers are the new geocentricists. We'll talk about that right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So, Louis, we have three cats on our boat, right? We live in this 1986 Chris Craft. It's an old cabin cruiser that's tied up in the public marina here in Washington, D.C. And it's sort of like living in a mobile home. You know, the bathroom is about the size of a typical closet, and the kitchen is a little bit bigger. But it's, you know, we like it. It's we're out in nature, and it's actually inexpensive. The rent is cheap. And it's a really nice, very diverse middle-class community that we live in, and it's cool. So anyhow, the boat next to us had these two pigeons that were nesting. And we have three cats. And the cats were going nuts. In fact, one of the cats, Fang, started ripping the screen open, so we had to close the window, you know, because he was just trying to tear right through the screen to get to the pigeons. And finally, the pigeons went away. In fact, Louise called the guy who owned the boat because he wasn't staying on the boat. I mean, we live on ours. This guy is just, you know, visiting. Actually, a former member of Congress. And nice guy. And So I think somebody came over and shooed them off, and we thought everything is cool. And while I was in Germany, Louise kept hearing these pigeons, but she couldn't see them. I come back, and on the back of a boat, there's a cleat that you tie a rope to, and then you tie that rope to the dock. And there's a little box. It's about a foot tall, a foot wide, and 8 inches deep, with a handle on it, and you pop that thing open and you can get at the cleat, and otherwise you keep it closed because the rope ties around the cleat, and then it goes out a hole on the side of the boat. And so if there's rain and stuff, you don't want the water to come in. So you got a door that you close, right? So she pops open the door, and there's a pigeon sitting there with two eggs in a nest. Pigeon laid it put a nest in our boat. Now, this is creating a real dilemma for me, because I have been, as you well know, for the better part of 10 years, saying that pigeons are actually not real, that they are robots in the planet Xenu, that they are sent here to spy on us. And I'm trying to figure this one out. Are these pigeons actually cleverly painted doves who are actually having eggs that are going to hatch? Or are they robots with pretend eggs, and they're inside my boat now, in this little box, you know, where the cleat is, so that they can listen more carefully to everything that goes on inside our boat? Yeah, there you go. I'm going to have to get, you know, a picture of this, and we'll put it up on a website. Although I'm, you know, Louise opened the door once, I opened the door. When I opened the door, that little female pigeon did not look at all happy, and I'm reluctant to make life too miserable for her, even to get a camera shot. But we'll see. If we start hearing little peeps, then I'll let you know. So I don't know. Maybe I owe the pigeons of the world an apology, but I think I'm being spied on. I really do. I don't think it's the NSA we got to worry about. Yeah, I'm serious. Just, you know, ask Tom Cruise. 10,000 years ago, the people, the Thetans from the planet Xenu, came here and seeded earth with human beings, and when enough of us are clear, they're going to come back and take us all back up into the sky in the spaceships, and we'll go off to Xenu and live in paradise. This is the, I mean, you know, you give Scientology $100,000 and this is what they'll tell you. More or less. I mean, I may have some of the details wrong because I didn't cough up the money. I just read the book of a guy who did. But it makes sense to me. And you know, wherever you go, where there are, you know, rich people, powerful people, or media figures, and I might not be the first two, but I'm certainly in the third, what do you have? You have pigeons. They're spies. Every 6 months, the mothership comes down, takes up the last batch, drops a new batch, and then, you know, they probably used to have little tape recorders in them. Now, I'll bet they got digital chips, and they download them. Yeah, keep up with technology. Maybe they always did. I mean, if they can travel across interstellar space. So, anyway. Which brings me to the new geocentrists, which is only slightly weirder than my thinking that a pigeon on my boat is actually a spy from the planet Xenu. There are people who believe that the Earth is the center of the universe. Now, that was the majority opinion in Western civilization up until about 400 or 500 years ago when Kepler and Copernicus and Galileo started looking through telescopes and doing math and going, whoa, wait a minute. The Earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. And not only that, the sun is going around other things or in other things. This Milky Way galaxy. Then eventually we figured out that our galaxy, that you look up at the sky and see all those points of light. A whole big pile of those points of light. I mean, if you're looking right through the middle of the sky at that thick layer, that's the Milky Way. A lot of those are stars. Most of those are stars. But if you're looking off to the corners, you're looking at galaxies. Each one of them has a billion stars or more in it. So anyhow, there's people who think that all of that is going around us. We're right at the center of it. And this woman who was an actress on Star Trek ended up taking a gig as a, you know, to narrate a movie and the principal. And she's now had to come out and say, I had no idea. This was about geocentricism, the belief that the Earth is at the center of the universe. Probably more than 3% of Americans believe that the Earth is at the center of the universe. But only 3% of scientists who've ever been published in scientific peer-reviewed papers, and really it's increasingly getting closer to 1%, think that global warming is not caused by human beings burning fossil fuels, principally. And in fact, the big argument among that 2 or 3% that you know, Fox News likes to quote is not whether or not global warming is happening and not whether or not humans are playing a role in global warming happening, but to what extent humans are playing a role. So what's the difference between me and my pigeons and this guy making this movie that got this poor woman who, you know, of Star Trek fame to voice it, and the fact that every single Republican freshman member of the House of Representatives in the last election believes and will tell you there ain't no such thing as human-made climate change. It's as nutty an idea as the Earth being at the center of the universe or as pigeons being spies from the planet Xenu, although that's not so nutty, but still. It is as nutty an idea. What's the difference? It has billionaires behind it who are sitting on trillions of dollars worth of carbon underground, and they will not make that money unless they bring that carbon up above ground, burn it, and throw the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And, you know, we need to seriously do something about this. We need to start treating these climate change deniers as if they are as crazy as the people who think that the Earth is at the center of the universe and that pigeons are spies from the planet Xenu. I will confess, I'm probably wrong. But I think it's time for us to start to stop taking these, you know, this argument seriously, and even go beyond that and start calling out the people who are putting millions of dollars, the ExxonMobils of the world, the Koch brothers of the world, putting millions of dollars into climate change denial as the liars that they are.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And not just lies, but lies that could endanger the future of our children, our grandchildren, and maybe even us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dolores in Bryan, Ohio. Hey, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for listening to your phone.
Pardon me?
Thanks for listening to your phone this time. I appreciate it.
I was so excited I pushed the wrong button.
Oh, I see. Okay. So what's up?
I'm calling because you've alluded several times lately. I tried to get you last week, too, about something that triggers in my mind. And earlier today you said, what could unify us all? What could get all these disparate opinions? You know, we all activists have different causes that we are deeply enmeshed in. I've been working with Move to Amend. We got a resolution passed in the city of Defiance. I'm close to Defiance here. And we passed a resolution with 67% of the vote in November. So that is a passion for me. And there are others who are passionate about the climate and passionate about the rights of labor. What we have to do is get all of these people to coalesce with motivation to accept the good we all are bringing to the table and stand up for ourselves. And when I think about Bernie Sanders and the effort to put him on the Democratic ticket as a progressive, it just makes my blood boil because I was a progressive Democrat and I have given it up. I have finally decided no way can I support a party that is still bought and paid for by big finance. I mean, I look at President Obama's message of hope and change and how I worked so hard to get him elected, and I see now he was bought and paid for. Maybe he was threatened, who knows? Maybe they said, what happened to JFK could happen to you, so just be calm, be careful, follow, do what we tell you. Could be they did that. I wouldn't be surprised. But if Bernie Sanders, who recognized that he needed to be an independent when he ran, I don't know if he did it when he was in the House as well, but
he
I
did.
Know now he is. Did he?
Yeah, he was the mayor of Burlington. He was a socialist the first time he was elected. The second time he was elected as mayor, he became an independent, and he has been an independent ever since.
Good. And he realized that neither party was the means or would be something he could, you know, associate himself with.
Right.
He needs to claim, I would say, go beyond independence, go back to the 100 years ago when the populist party was trying to get started and they cut it off. They cut off the head of the octopus because they couldn't, they knew they'd never.
Well, the populist party was one of the main reasons why you ended up with Taft as president, why you ended up with a Republican. I mean, you know, they split the Democratic vote.
Well, I'm so upset though about I know I can't do that. I know that
yeah.
But I see no alternative, and I can see Bernie Sanders running with Elizabeth Warren on a populist ticket. If all of those groups, the Green Party, the Justice Party, and labor, and immigrants, and all of these groups, and get to
we'll just have to see, Dolores, how it plays out. Thank you for the call. And the song was We Can't Make It Here Anymore, and it's by James McMurtry. And at one time, a number of years ago, he actually gave us permission to play it on the air, but the permission for music is very different from radio and TV, and now that our show is simulcast on TV as well as on radio, we can't do it, or I would love to play that for you. But the lyrics are just in, you know, a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, flag on the wheelchair, flapping in the breeze, one leg missing, both hands free. No one's paying him much mind. The VA's budget stretched so thin. And then there's more coming home from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And then he goes on through all this, you know, it's just, we just can't make it here anymore. It's absolutely brilliant. Don in Wheaton, Illinois. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I heard that you're going to cover more about the pipeline tonight. And I just wanted to throw something else in the mix. First of all, I agree that, you know, probably most of the jobs that might be created might be, after more climate change destruction, you know. But anyway, what I was saying is it seems that that would be a large area across our country that would have to be probably guarded, because that would also be like a terrorist target.
Yeah. I've made that point many times. I mean, the entire Keystone XL pipeline is a giant bullseye for anybody with, and you don't even have to be a highly, you know, sophisticated terrorist. You don't have to, you know, fly a plane into it. All you need is a pickup truck and a case of dynamite.
Right, and just like down in the Mexican border right now, you know, it's, you know, a big problem there. They're just, you know, watching people and building walls, trying to keep people out there, and that's a pretty long area. This pipeline would be much longer.
Yeah.
And you know, that if we want to create jobs, we need to, you know, work on the infrastructure, not have guys.
If we want to create jobs, we need to be putting solar panels on the roof of every house in America. I just, you know, I spent the weekend in Germany, and it's just amazing. I took the train from Frankfurt to Würzburg, and then from Würzburg to Bad Kissingen, and which was mostly, you know, west to east all the way. And so I'm sitting on the side of the train, looking north up on the southern roofs of all these houses. And I'll tell you, damn near every house that was positioned, and a lot of these houses were built 500 years ago. I mean, they weren't thinking solar power back then. But damn near every house that was positioned in a way that they had largely southern exposure, their roofs were covered with solar collectors.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's just amazing. I mean, you know, Germany set out to build the equivalent of two nuclear power plants with a very small subsidy, cost the government virtually nothing, basically just backstopping the mortgages for people who were homeowners who wanted to put solar up, you know, things on their roofs. And it not only created 50, 60,000 jobs almost immediately, but they generated the equivalent of 10 nuclear reactors worth of power. They had to stop the subsidy program last year because there's so much electricity now flowing into the German grid. They got to rebuild the grid before they can go any farther. They got to turn it into a smart grid. When I was on the train, you can click a little box and pay an extra €2, an extra $3, and have 100% of your trip paid for with green electricity. Well, it's because they got so much flowing around, you know, it's just amazing. So yeah, we've got. And the other irony, Don, is the ultimate job creation. You know, one of the things that does jack up GDP is disasters. You know, when Hurricane Sandy hit New Jersey, it radically increased the GDP of New Jersey. I mean, it wiped out people's lives and all that kind of stuff. But rebuilding from disasters, the Gulf Coast, rebuilding from the blowout in the Macondo well, all these things actually stimulate GDP. And as Bobby Kennedy pointed out, it's a terrible way to stimulate GDP. And we, instead, what we should be doing is we should be putting solar panels on the roof of every house, and every community that's got enough wind should have their own, you know, wind farm going. And you know, we need to electrify our automobile fleet. Don, thanks for the call. Good point. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto, what's up?
Tom, in response to your question, how can we bring everyone together on the same page when it comes to realizing that it's that top 1%, the elite capitalist class, that is really screwing all of us around? That's going to be very tough, and I'll tell you why. I've come to the conclusion that despite the different religions that exist in America, most Americans subscribe basically to one big religion. And they've been indoctrinated very thoroughly into it, and that's the religion of capitalism.
Yeah.
Americans really do believe, in general, that it's the wealthy, the super rich, that is really keeping this country together and functioning, and that without them, we're not going to make it. And that, in fact, in America, an American has to set a goal of becoming rich and wealthy himself. Until we can break that religious devotion to capitalism, what you want to do is very, very tough. And just to end my call, we are also one of the most fundamentalist countries in the world as far as religion is concerned. About 45% of Americans subscribe to some form of Christian fundamentalism. And the reason why I'm bringing that up, the political right wing and the religious right wing go hand in hand.
Well, not only that, you know the largest, the most rapidly growing strain within Christian fundamentalism is prosperity theology.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you for bringing that up. They go hand in hand with each other, and prosperity theology, basically, it's a clever, devious way of interpreting the Bible in which capitalism is presented as God's divinely chosen economic and social system for the world.
Yeah, it's a modern-day version of John Calvin on steroids. And excellent point, Umberto. Thank you for calling and making it. We need to wake people up from this, and you're right. Capitalism has become and is treated by many Americans as a religion. It's a very dysfunctional religion. This is where Thomas, it looks like Piketty, I think it's pronounced Piketty, this new book on capital is so brilliant.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I read a good chunk of it on the airplane to and from Germany this weekend, and it's just amazing. I think I told you about it yesterday. I'll repeat it again one of these days soon. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very cantorously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Nebraska. While most Republican-led states are trying to make it harder to vote, blood-red Nebraska is doing the opposite. Governor Dave Heineman, a Republican, has signed into law a bill that would allow same-day registration in the Cornhusker state. Although not as progressive as some other same-day registration laws, Nebraska's new voting law is a welcome sign, especially since it was passed by Republicans in the state legislature and signed by a Republican governor. Voting rights are not a liberal issue, they're an American issue. Good on Nebraska for making that point clear. The bad, Donald Trump, the billionaire Americans love to hate, is at it again. In a now-deleted tweet sent out yesterday, Donald complained that the way President Obama walks out of Air Force One is unpresidential. Trump said, the way President Obama runs down the stairs of Air Force One, hopping, bobbing, and jumping all the way, is so inelegant and so unpresidential. Right. I think it's safe to say that Trump's tweets say more about his desperate need for attention and new hair plugs than it does about President Obama. And the very, very ugly David Horowitz. During an appearance on Sean Hannity's radio show yesterday, the conservative pundit argued that liberals, yes, liberals, and President Obama were to blame for last week's shootings at a Kansas City Jewish community center. I'm not making this up. Take a listen.
And this Kansas City shooter, I mean, he's a Ku Klux Klaner. He's a Democrat, lifelong Democrat, and Ku Klux Klan racist and anti-Semite. But he's obviously been encouraged. And the irony, of course, is that he killed three Christians. Obviously encouraged by the American left. The alliance between the American left and the Islamo, I don't call them Islamo-fascists anymore. They're Nazis. After the Second World War, there was a certain intolerance for those attitudes. Thanks to the American left, which goes right into the White House. Obama is also responsible for this, attacking Israel.
Yeah, whether you're a fan of President Obama or not, accusing him of fomenting attacks on Jewish people is just the worst kind of smear attack. Sean Hannity should be ashamed of himself for allowing David Horowitz to say that kind of stuff on the air. That's just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay. James in Fresno, California. Hey, James, what's up? James, you are on the air. James is not on the air. He's spotted up. Okay, let's try Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, can you hear me?
Hey, good day, Tom. May I break from my initial comment? I wanted to make a comment on the guys out at the rancher in Arizona and that sheriff.
Yeah,
I understand you want to make peace and let everybody have their voice, and that's a good thing, but I'm afraid to let them guys in my boat because they might roll over in their sleep and shoot a hole in the bottom of it. So
that's a good point.
Thank you. My comment on the I live in the area, not in Nebraska, but in Iowa. Mm. It would be relatively close to where the pipeline is going to come through.
Yeah.
And right now, we just got through with a drought a couple of years ago, and then we had a little drought relief 2 years ago, and then last year was decent with a good crop. And this spring, we're already back in another drought.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that this tar sands pipeline, they've done I saw a documentary on it, and they're going to be drawing their water to move the initial to pump it from Canada out of a river. And there are times in drought up there when there's not enough water to pump. So understanding that rivers are fed with rain and in times of drought they go shy and glacial runoff and the glaciers are receding, aren't we setting ourselves up by using this fresh water for to transport this oil? Aren't we really setting ourselves up for a water catastrophe for drinking water and crops?
Well, we could be. I mean, in the United States, we're setting ourselves up for a catastrophe if there's leakage, because this tar sands oil is not actually oil. It's ground up coal. It's bituminous coal. And it's ground up and dissolved with old fashioned oil and water, as you correctly point out, so that it can be punched, pumped through the pipeline. And because it is ground up coal, rather than floating on the top of water like oil does, it settles into the ground. And so if it spills anywhere over the Ogallala Aquifer in an area where, there's only a few feet between the surface and the aquifer, and there are such areas, it can get into the aquifer, and you're talking about, contamination of hundreds of billions of gallons of water, number one. Number two, your point is really well taken. You've got river water up in Alberta that's being mixed with this ground-up coal slurry to pump it down the pipeline. And if they run out of water and they're facing a water crisis up there, then, the whole thing falls apart. But, basically, there is so much profit to be made on this that these guys are just, they're just pumping it. They don't care if it's 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the line. The cost of building the pipeline is relatively small compared to the incredible profit that they're going to make on this stuff, given the current price of oil and the fact that they're going to be refining it down in Texas, leaving all the poison here in the United States and shipping the gasoline and diesel fuel off to China and to Brazil and to Mexico and to England. And I mean, they've already got the buyers lined up, and it's going to raise the cost of gasoline and diesel fuel in the United States, because right now we actually do have a Keystone pipeline that comes from Alberta and ends in St. Louis and then takes a left turn and goes over to Ohio. And we're refining that stuff into gasoline here in the United States right now. And it's helping keep the cost of gasoline down. So it's going to raise the cost of gasoline. So you're right, Randy. And there's a whole lot of, just truth about this stuff that nobody knows. Thanks for calling and bringing it up. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to get your take on this. I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Warren. And last night I was watching her because she was interviewed on The Daily Show. And John asked her about a tax, a 2-3% increase on medical device manufacturers, and apparently this is in the ACA.
Right.
And I didn't get whether this is national or Massachusetts to this thing that this company is the second largest seller of devices, medical devices. Now, again, I'm not sure if it's Massachusetts or the country, but she voted against an increase.
Hmm.
And what she said was that she's against taxing manufacturers extra of any kind because we have to produce more manufacturing in this country. And then she, totally changed the subject back to something that they were discussing before. And right there, to me, she played politician. To me, she was the status quo. And it was very disappointing. What do you think?
I don't know. I do know that there's an investment newsletter that I subscribe to, and they suggested some time back that you buy medical device manufacturing stock, which I did not do, but I watched it, and it has gone up. So apparently these companies have not been hurt by the ACA. She, in all probability, I think she's probably just, you know, being a politician is representing Massachusetts. In theory, that's what she's supposed to do. So, but I don't know the situation well enough to criticize her or praise her for what she said. So I'm sorry, Kathy. But thank you for the call. And thanks for raising the issue. Patrick in Park City, Utah. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you, man? Always great to connect with you. I'm doing my favorite lunchtime activity and catching up with you.
Okay. Thank you. What's up?
Am I on?
You are. You are on the air.
Okay, so sorry about that. So, I had a bit of an echo. I've been on your show. I made a film. I just graduated from the Tom Hartman University, having read through a signed copy of The Crash of 2016. And I've got to tell you, Tom, I've said this to Sean Taylor in the past. I hope you can watch my film, Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. It was on Free Speech TV because it aligns exactly with where the 20s. I mean, I can't believe how incredibly aligned it is, because I only discovered you about 16 months ago. But the long and the short of it is, we have come up with, I believe, the solution to galvanize people to get on the road to, you know, creating a resurgence of the American dream, or, quite frankly, turning the tables on the status quo.
Okay.
Can I tell you a little bit about it?
What is it?
Look, the bottom line is, man, we've turned the tables on this notion of the super PAC. We created the Everyman Super PAC.
Mm-hmm.
At www.everymansuperpac.com. And quite frankly, right, it follows the trajectory of the crash of 2016.
So you want to fight fire with fire?
Yeah, I think so. Because at the end of the day, the game is played the way the game is played. In fact,
but why not change the rules of the game?
Well, of course we've got to. But isn't it first? I mean, don't we have to basically make an impact in the 2014 elections first with a populist movement?
You got $500 million?
That's the idea. If we can raise, well, I don't even want to go to that point because it is listed on the EverymanSuperPAC.com website. And I would encourage you personally, I hope, because we're on the same page as Move to Amend, because we've got the back end. Because I lost my home to foreclosure in 2016. Here's the key. We've got to connect with the 10 to 26 million people who lost their homes, who are working two jobs apiece, that are hanging on by their fingernails.
But you're asking them to give you money?
No, well, not necessarily. Not necessarily then. But at the same time, yes and no. But at the same time,
I get it, Patrick. And you know, creating a super PAC might be a noble thing, or it might be a way to create a new business that you can skim a little off the top. I honestly don't know. But I think, frankly, the way to do it is not with a super PAC. I think it's by changing the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Respectfully. And all the praise in the world of me is not going to cause me to agree with you, necessarily. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And is it the third hour of the program? It's the second hour. We got callers from KPFK. That's interesting. I will... James in Los Angeles. Are we live on the air on KPFK right now, James? Or do you just normally listen and you're listening some other way and calling in?
I'm watching on Free Speech TV.
Oh, cool. Okay. So what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to answer your question on how to bring everybody together, and I think we need to reclaim populism back from the corporate media. I mean, because nowadays people that are populist are either ranters or anti-government mobs, or these, you know, anything goes corporatists, you know, claiming to be conservatives. And I think we just need more populist movements like Move to Amend and Occupy Wall Street, and even More Mondays.
Well, this is, I've been making this point for years, is that Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party, at least on the ground, at the level of the individual person who shows up and says, yes, sign me up, they're the same thing. They're populist movements. Now, you know, at the more senior levels, you will find in some of the Occupy groups, you find people who are Marxists, and others you'll find people who are anarchists, and others you find people who are, you know, who knows what. And the same thing with the Tea Party groups. You know, you move up the leadership ladder, And at least at the local level, you may find people who are just, you know, Republican conservatives. More often than not, though, what you find are people who are shilling for the billionaires. But at the grassroots level, if we could just extract the grassroots people from both Occupy and move the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, I think you would find that we have so much more in common than we have that divides us. We're all being screwed by the same, you know, billionaire class.
Yeah, it's not really right to left. I think right to left are just political theories. You know,
yeah.
Reality is top to bottom. And the bottom is just being drowned out by all the money and all the corporate power in that.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. James, thanks a lot for the call. Chuck in Winter Park, Maine, listening, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about two of your pet peeves. One has to do with private prisons.
Okay.
Because I worked in that system for about 17 years, and our total emphasis was on providing alternatives to people in institutions.
Right, because it costs money to put people in prison. But now you've got a private prison industry. They want to make money putting people in prison.
And they've got four times the population now than they did in 1980.
Wow.
Four times as many people in prison.
Wow. Welcome to the wonderful world of Nixon's drug war and Reaganomics and privatization.
Right. I just want to add another thing. Regarding the Bureau of Land Management, where I was working, I happened to get a call from somebody at BLM because they had 30,000 wild mules, which they wanted to do something with. And was there somewhere where we can use 30,000 wild mules in the criminal justice system?
Really?
Rather than kill them all.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to those 30,000, but I've always had a warm feeling towards the BLM that they would go to that effort.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know, you know, in some places they use convicts to break horses, you know, to train them to be rideable. And I have a friend in Australia, actually, who does that with severely abused kids and kids who are addicted to sniffing gasoline and things. But mules, that's a new one for me. Chuck, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Find out what's going on in the world. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, former member of the U.S. House of Representatives, reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. And you?
I'm okay, better than I deserve.
Okay, so what's going on in the world?
You know, there's something domestic here that I wanted to mention that's it's probably going to get some heat from the Republican side, but it's really an amazing step, and the Department of Justice has announced clemency overhaul, and that will allow for the release of some people that have served over 10 years in the federal prison system.
Mm-hmm.
It's geared to drug offenders, and there's some pretty strict criteria. There's about six different levels that people have to meet. But it goes back to the crack cocaine guideline sentencing that really intensified the sentencing time for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. And that was a result of the death of Len Bias, the basketball player, years ago.
Right.
And everybody knew, and I can speak from firsthand experience, you know, have been in the federal system with 78% of the people who were drug offenders, that a lot of people are addicts. They were nonviolent. They were, you know, what we would deem to be low-level, non-dangerous offenders, but they got amazing sentences, 20 years, 22, et cetera. And now the Department of Justice is looking for the first time in really modern history in America to do something about it and to start this process where they will work pro bono to see if these prisoners qualify. So they're not opening the floodgates, which is what we'll hear probably from the Republican side, but I think this is going to be a very pragmatic way to deal with the problem out there.
Wow. Seems like a start. And I think you're right. I mean, as you've seen firsthand, it's the problem of addiction in our prisons and mental illness. I mean, it's just a tragedy that our prisons have become the way that we treat people who are either addicted, you know, have a medical problem, or mentally ill, have a medical and mental problem, also a medical problem. So what else is going on?
On a political note, and I thought this quote was interesting from Barbara Bush, because previously she said, we've had enough Bushes, and isn't there some other family that can run for president? But the former Governor Jeb Bush has said, quote, "I'm thinking about running for president." So that will put
Jeb.
Him on the Jeb Bush.
Yeah, it's going to be Bush versus Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, and this will put him on the front pages. And, of course, it'll be the Tea Party, quote, Rand Paul, you know, versus Jeb Bush. And if you look back at our history of the Republican Party, if you look back just the last time you took the Tea Party darling, which would be Rick Santorum, could not even get near Mitt Romney.
Yeah, although, you know, there may be more parallels to 1960 than to 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm crazy, Bob. I mean, you've been a politician and you were in the Republican Party. You know these people better than I do. But I remember the, excuse me, six, not 60, 64. I remember the 64 election. I was 13 years old, but I was very, very politically conscious. My dad was a Republican activist, and I think I've told you before, I went door to door with my dad for Barry Goldwater when I was 13. And Goldwater in 64 was basically the Rand Paul of that era.
That's true.
And he became the party's nominee. I mean, I play the clips from time to time of, you know, of Rockefeller getting up and saying we all have to calm down and talk rationally. He got booed down. And then Barry Goldwater gets up and says, you know, extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice. And he's, you know, 3 minutes of standing cheering. And then he says and moderation in the defense of or whatever, you know, is something in defense of moderation is no virtue. And again, the crowd explodes and he becomes the nominee. I mean, I just think there's a possible, you know, I don't, Ted Cruz wants it so bad he can taste it, but he's
out of it.
Yeah. He's too wacky.
He'll never have it. I personally think with the Republicans, there's a fear of the fatigue of the Bush name.
Yeah.
You know, amongst Republicans and.
Except Jeb is rational. He's reasonably younger and attractive. His wife is Hispanic. He speaks fluent Spanish. I mean, he was the guy. He was supposed to be the nominee in 2000. He was the one his dad and mom wanted to be the nominee, and Karl Rove outmaneuvered them. You know.
That's true.
So
they'll have to keep Karl Rove out of the scene too, away from Jeb.
Well, I don't think Karl has the power that he once had. I don't think
no,
he's taken seriously.
He has that direct power with Bush 43.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was interesting. He's, you know, this is the first time he's actually said, "Hey, I'm actually, you know, thinking about doing it." So it puts a lot of political news out in the front. Forefront.
Yep.
And then the other thing, you know, with Daryl Issa basically screwing up anything he could on the IRS here.
One of the only convicted criminals in Congress.
What's that?
One of the only convicted criminals in Congress.
Yeah, and he's still there.
Yeah.
And with the auto theft thing, then he turned that into a multi-million dollar business.
Yeah.
Which is what he did.
Yeah.
But, you know, he screwed
made
up.
Made in China, too.
The announcement today by the IRS has nothing to do with Daryl Issa, but they have been giving below the, quote, top executives of the IRS, they have been giving some bonuses to some employees they found out that have not paid their taxes. So I think you'll.
Oh, no.
I think you'll see some immediate correction of that is the reason I'm reporting that story.
Now, here's the question. Tax day was April 15th, right? And I've, we own a small business and our taxes are kind of, and I've got three different sources of income. I got the radio show, I got the TV show, and I write books. And occasionally I get a speaking fee or something. And so my taxes are a mess. And so we hire a guy to do it for us. And he's like, you know, let me file an extension for you because I'm crazier than one arm paper hanger here on April 15th. So we filed we estimated our taxes, we paid, you know, so I'm not going to be in arrears or anything, but I've got another 3 months. So technically I haven't paid my taxes.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, although it's all perfectly legal and it's fairly commonly done among people who have more than just a simple, you know, job and a simple 1099 and they just take a standard deduction and send it in. So I'm wondering if those people at the IRS who, quote, haven't paid their taxes, end quote, are actually people who are doing what I've done. They've taken they've deferred, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. It's just a harder line will be taken by the public on them. You know,
yeah, but I mean, you know, is this just demagoguery? Is this, you know, attacking them for doing something that's perfectly normal and legal and done by lots and lots of people? I don't honestly know the answer to the question, but I'd love to find out. If you can find out, would you let me know, Bob?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good talking to you. Bob Nay, be sure and check out his book, Sideswiped.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And a special treat here for our third hour today. Professor Stephen Cohen. I have an honorary PhD from... Maybe you could call me Dr. Hartman, Professor Cohen. Anyhow, Professor Stephen Cohen, New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, the website thenation.com. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
My elderly aunt said when I got my PhD, all those years and you could have been a real doctor.
Yeah.
So the PhD doesn't have a lot of currency in some circles.
Yeah, and mine was Goddard College. It was the first honorary PhD they'd done in the 100-year history of the college. So it was kind of a big deal, but, you know.
It is indeed. I congratulate you.
Thank you. But it's still an honorary PhD. So, but let's talk about Ukraine and what's going on there. I had an eye-popping. I was in Germany over the weekend, and one of the German newspapers, I think it was Der Bild, one of the German newspapers had an interesting article on the front page about how the and correct me if I misunderstood this, because my German, I used to be fairly good. I lived in Germany back in 86 and 87, but I never studied it in school. And so it's nur Straßendeutsch, you know, that's just street German. But my understanding of this article was basically that the industrial complex in the cities in the east part of Ukraine are almost exclusively military industrial complex types of facilities, that they manufacture mostly weaponry for the Russian military, and that in fact there are several major Russian pieces of military equipment, a jet and a missile, as I recall, that literally the Russians can't make without the factories in the eastern part of Ukraine. Do I have that right?
More or less. But could I, since you mentioned Germany, could I mention that we're living through an astonishing and shameful moment before we begin?
Please.
Last Sunday, April 20th, there appeared on the front page of the New York Times a report by Peter Baker, which reported, and this is the astonishing news or the historic news, that President Obama, because of the Ukrainian crisis, has given up any hope of dealing in a positive way with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I read that piece.
And therefore, President Obama has adopted a new strategy, as Baker calls it, a new policy, which is no longer to try to cooperate with Russia, but to treat Russia as a pariah state. And in this pursuit, to adopt or readopt, and this is the word that was reported and used, a policy of containment. Now, containment was, of course, the 45-year American policy during the preceding Cold War. Therefore, it seems right to say that this week, as we talk now, we, the United States, are now officially in a declared Cold War with Russia.
Assuming that this article, when I read the article as an op-ed, and I...
Tom, it appeared on the front page of the paper.
Okay,
the paper
I read it on my phone. Sorry.
On the front page of the Times,
okay.
Column left is at the top.
Yeah.
Baker is a very authoritative reporting voice at the Times. Probably is their lead political reporter when it comes to Washington. But more importantly, there was not one word of denial or revision, nor has there been for the last 3 days, from the White House. So we have to assume that Baker got the gist of the revised policy and discussion in the White House correct. Now, the other half of that, and this is what made me think of Germany and your visit there. In Germany today, for various reasons, there is a full political media debate about the Ukrainian crisis and who, Russia, Europe, or the United States, bears most responsibility for it, and therefore great uncertainty about what Western policy should be. That's democracy working. In the United States, there has not been one public word from any member of our media political establishment, Republican, Democratic, reactionary, progressive, not a word in the mainstream. Now, by mainstream, I mean those publications and those radio shows and those broadcasts that our policy elite reads and watches, shapes, and is shaped by it. And there you have either full-throated cheerleading, look at most any Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, full-throated support for this new militarization of relations with Russia, or silence. So I think future historians will look back and say two things, if there are any future historians, because there's going to be an arms race now. One, this is the week that the United States officially declared Cold War on Russia, though it's been unfolding for 20 years. And two, the so-called democratic American bipartisan political system was absent. It's a shameful day, a shameful week, and there are people such as yourself. There's John Batchelor on ABC. There's Democracy Now. There are important broadcasts that put on alternative voices, dissenting voices. But if they impact the mainstream, policy mainstream, it's only over a long period of time. And by then, as we see now, a long time is too late. So that's where we stand today. And meanwhile, of course, we are sending NATO troops, American troops too, deeper into Eastern Europe. It's not a large force, 175 paratroopers, as reported also in the Times today, but elsewhere, into Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, on Russia's borders.
Right.
It's not really clear how many there'll be altogether yet, but there's symbolic importance.
And Poland is the big concern.
Well, Poland is the big one. And, of course, nobody pays any attention to what President Putin says, but he discussed all this at length in the last 2 weeks. And he says if this keeps up, there's no way we can avoid a new nuclear arms race. He was referring at that moment to American warships sailing in and out of the Black Sea in range of Russia carrying anti-ballistic missile devices, which Russia interprets as a threat to deprive it of its nuclear deterrence. Therefore, in all likelihood, Russia will begin to deploy and build more of those so-called intermediate-range missiles, which were the only category of nuclear weapons ever abolished, for all Obama's talk about this. And they were abolished, of course, by Gorbachev and Reagan in 1987, I think. They are coming back.
Wow. Now, this article that I read in Germany, my takeaway from it was that it was almost like they were saying Russia needs these Eastern Ukrainian cities to make their weapons, and therefore maybe we should not be so quick to jump in and be so rigid about these borders or whatever. I mean, it was like... This is an issue we need to seriously consider. I've heard no discussion like that in the United States.
But what if that's the purpose of Western policy, to deprive Russia of its military industrial base in Ukraine?
Oh, my God.
Then you would say, is it successful or not?
Then I'd say the neocons have won.
They have won. What we're living with now are the consequences. But the neocons aren't just Republicans.
Right.
They're Democrats.
Sure, sure. Yeah, they are totally transpartisan. We'll be back with more of Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, from Stalinism to the perhaps prophetically titled New Cold War.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can read Professor Cohen's writing, of course, over at thenation.com. So, Professor Cohen, if we have entered into a new Cold War with Russia, what does that mean? How does that change the average life of America? I remember the old Cold War. I'm old enough to remember duck and cover. I remember all the demagoguery. I remember all the tax money going to the nuclear missiles and all that kind of stuff. But what will that mean this time?
Well, when I saw this coming back in February, I called a friend down in the small town in Kentucky where I grew up and asked him if the nuclear fallout shelter that my father had built back in the 1950s was still functioning. I just, the cat and I might exile ourselves in Kentucky.
Mm.
That's a joke to remind us that my generation and yours, I'm probably a generation older than you.
I'm 63.
Well,
I was born in 51.
It depends on, we consider generation 20 years, political generation.
Right.
So we would be of the same generation, but I'm older than you.
Okay.
But we both remember, that's the point, and my grown children remember. What it meant to grow up during the Cold War. On a personal level, we lived with the anxiety of nuclear war. As a nation, we lived with expenditures that gutted our social progress. We lived with international politics that corrupted our domestic politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, not only would I say it, I insist that this new Cold War, if it's allowed to develop, and it's hard to see how it can be stopped now because whatever we think of Putin, whatever we think of him, there is zero leadership coming out of the White House. If it develops, it will be more dangerous, by which I mean more apt to lead to actual war, conventional or nuclear, than was the last Cold War, for two reasons. The epicenter of the last Cold War was rather far from Russia, in Berlin, divided Berlin.
Right.
This Cold War is right on Russia's borders in Ukraine, and not only on its borders, but through the heart, to the extent that Ukraine is divided, as it is, through the heart of Russia's traditional historical Slavic civilization. So this is an open wound that you can't put a Band-Aid on, unlike Berlin, unlike Eastern and Central Europe. The other reason is, and I probably remember this better than you do, during the last Cold War, the 45-year Cold War, rules of stabilizing behavior developed, particularly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when both sides, Soviet and America, realized that the other had red lines that the other and each dare not cross for fear of launching real war. So we went into the business of back-channel communications. We negotiated a lot of treaties that required informing each other about troop movements. There was the hotline was installed. So a whole series, a kind of gossamer world of stabilizing behavior and mechanisms were created. None of that exists now. None of it exists. And what will, if you read, I read only the Russian and the American press. Both are so full of misinformation that when I finish my daily 2 hours reading of the press, I am so angry because it would take 2 weeks to correct what appears, whether it's in a Russian newspaper or the New York Times, particularly in the opinion columns.
Yeah, yeah, to untangle it all. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen. He writes for the contributing editor to thenation.com and Professor Emeritus at NYU and Princeton, and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tom Hartman. Hartman Program, Talk Media for the Sane Left Among Us. Professor Stephen Cohen on the line with us. He is the professor emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor with The Nation magazine, the author of the book, perhaps presciently titled, at least toward the end, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War, which was apparently declared over the weekend, as we were talking a little earlier, thenation.com for his writings, of course. Professor Cohen, we were just talking about what might this new Cold War look like and what we both remembered from our childhood, our younger years. The probably the seminal event of my teenage years was a proxy war that was part of the Cold War, which was Vietnam. What are your thoughts on, first of all, do you think that that's a reasonable analysis of what Vietnam was? And secondly, might we be looking at that sort of thing where we're going to Russia, we're going to war with Russia, but we're not really going to war with Russia, and it's happening someplace else, you know, maybe someplace in Africa.
We've already had one example of that, and we don't have to be older guys, senior citizens, which you're not quite, to remember it.
Bless you.
In 2008, now everybody think back to 2008. It wasn't that long ago. There was a war, a brief war, in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia between the Russian army and the Georgian army, an army that had been created, armed, and minded by the United States. That was surely a proxy war. I wrote about it at the time, and I called it the American-Russian proxy war. The reason that's relevant now is that it was there in Georgia that the United States and NATO crossed one of the two declared lines, red lines of Russia. That is, taking Georgia into NATO. That's what that was all about. And Russia put a stop to that then. Now, Moscow believes that the United States and NATO have crossed the other and far more important red line in Ukraine. So might we see a proxy war in Ukraine? Now, if you can allow me one moment of self-advertisement, I have at thenation.com my most recent article. It's called Cold War Again, Who is Responsible? And there I set out the history leading up to this new Cold War. And I argue it's not the official history or narrative we're getting in the mainstream. You got to see the other guy's side of the story, the Russian side of the story. And the Russian side of the story is that we've been coming at them with NATO for 20 years, began with Clinton, the expansion, and now there's an assault, a march for the brass ring, the great prize, Ukraine. Now, what might that mean, to go back to your question? I think everybody would agree, even the White House, that Ukraine is on the verge of civil war, because Ukraine might have been one state, but it was never one country. It was at least two. The West leaning toward Europe, the East toward Russia. It may already be civil war. People are being killed mysteriously, showing up in rivers. Buildings are being occupied, both in the West, which we ignore, and in the East. If there's an actual civil war, almost certainly Putin will send Russian troops across the eastern border from Russia into Ukraine. And those NATO troops, which we see being mobilized in Eastern Europe, will be sent into Western Ukraine. And therefore, you could argue theoretically that a Ukrainian civil war will become a proxy war between Russia and the United States. But I would say, wait a minute. If NATO crosses Ukraine's borders and Russia crosses Ukraine's borders, we are at the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're eyeball to eyeball. And at that moment, then we're a bad thought, a mishap, a misunderstanding from actual war between Russia and America. That's why I think we've got to think this through, so yeah, that when President Obama lets it be known, he's not going to talk to Putin anymore. By the way, he once referred to Putin as a kind of sulky schoolboy. Why he would say this in public, I have no idea. But he did. But who's sulking now? He appears to be sulking in the White House because the White House thinks that Putin has, you know, done them in.
Yeah.
If you believe in this crazy game, this chessboard, this strategic, this lethal strategic nonsense that both sides pursue, Putin's been winning. We don't have a win, and it's almost as though Obama is, his feelings are hurt, and he's only going to talk about Obamacare.
Is there a we just have a couple of minutes left, Professor. Is there in Ukraine some equivalent of the 38th parallel in Korea, a logical place for troops on both sides to stop?
Probably Kiev, because it's the capital, because in the eyes of the Russians, the government, which came to power through a street coup and overthrew the president, has no legitimacy. By the same token, the United States and Europe have embraced the Kiev government. So I would guess the 38th parallel will be wherever that Kiev government is. If it flees Ukraine, and by the way, as we've seen this week, it has no support. It sent military troops to the east to deoccupy some buildings, and the troops handed their tanks and their guns and everything over to the people who were protecting the people who were occupying the buildings. It will need NATO power to survive. So wherever it is, that will be the line. But, you know, a Ukrainian civil war will be everywhere. And let me end by saying this. The relationship between Ukraine and Russia is also conjugal. There are tens of millions of mixed marriages. This civil war is going to run through the bedroom of every house in Ukraine. It never should have happened. And it was provoked by Europe and the United States, not by Putin. But he is now Mr. Pushback.
Yeah. And in fact, for his own political survival, he's going to have to maintain that position.
I'll let you think that, but if you want to have a conversation of Putin's motives, we ought to do that on another broadcast, because that has become the prevailing view, that either he's determined to rebuild the Soviet Union, or he must do this because he's weak at home and he has to shore up his popular...
You don't think either of those are the case?
Either is correct. They are factors in any politician's thinking, especially one who's in a war situation. He thinks of his support. Everybody, Putin polls every day the way Obama does, but that's not the driving force.
That's fascinating. Do you have the ability and time to stick around with us for a little bit?
What could be more important?
Okay, if you're willing to stick around with us, we've got to take a 6-minute break here at the bottom of the hour for the news, but then we'll continue the conversation, okay?
Are we off the air?
We are not off the air, no.
When we go off the air, I want to ask a question.
Okay, we'll do. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I hope we will be back with Professor Cohen. We'll find out in a second. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, and author of a new article in The Nation. You can read it at thenation.com. Cold War Again, Who's Responsible? The subtitle, in the name of, quote, democracy, the West has unrelentingly moved its military, political, and economic power ever closer to post-Soviet Russia. A very provocative subtitle and a brilliant article. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you so much for agreeing to stay with us here for the rest of this hour.
Nothing could be more important given the circumstances.
I agree. We're talking about the last two major nuclear powers doing a dance that is at least as dangerous as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it seems to me that the big difference is that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, most Americans realized the gravity of the situation, and today most Americans are, wondering what's Miley Cyrus going to do tomorrow.
I have a view about that because I hear this in Russia too. I spend a good deal of time in Moscow, where the Russian intelligentsia—they would say you and I are members of the American intelligentsia, though I don't think we really have one. We know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They tend to blame ordinary people, which is not unreasonable in a democracy. I mean, you might say, why don't ordinary people put a stop to this? But this is really the fault in the doing of our policy elite, whom nobody elected except for those in Congress and the White House. They are what the Russians used to call a nomenklatura, an appointed class. These are people who rotate in and out of government, in and out of editorial positions. It doesn't matter a whole lot if they're Republicans or Democrats. This is what they do. And they get paid well, and it's not hard manual labor. And my view has always been that in a democracy, they have one obligation, and that is to be critical-minded and factual. And they are the opposite of that in this run-up to war with Russia. And I won't mention names because I have friendly relations with some of these people. I've been around a long time and spent part of my life not only in universities, but I worked for CBS once. I used to write for American op-ed pages. I've been in and out of the media. But it is scandalous, the silence of the mainstream media and the politicians today. There's no precedent for it. We had a debate in the run-up of Vietnam, of Iraq, when there was almost a war with Iran and with Libya. There was a debate. But it appears that when it comes to Russia now, they have either lost their minds or their courage. And I would ask you a question. It's a hypothetical question. First, a factual question. How many elected members of Congress are there total? You got, what, 400 plus?
435 in the House and 100 in the Senate.
All right, so what's the total number there?
535.
All right, of 535 people, I have heard one publicly question, one and a half publicly question American policy toward Russia over Ukraine since the crisis began in November, almost 6 months ago. And that is a person I don't know personally by the name of, I think, Dana Rauschenbacher.
Rohrabacher. Yeah. Rohrabacher. And he walked it back, as I recall.
Well, he may have. But in the beginning, Rand Paul also said he thought we were bringing this, that we had built a bridge too far toward Russia.
Right.
But because Rubio is taking a hard line, and Rand would like to run in the primaries, the Republican primaries, he's fallen silent. So as we talk today, not one of, what did you say the number was, 500 and plus?
535, yes.
530, not one of 535 elected national officials have said, wait a minute, could, before we do what appears the White House has announced, new Cold War, and moving NATO troops all over the place, could we please take a deep breath and maybe have a few days of discussion and debate about this? Much less oppose it. Not one.
Is that not happen? I mean, no. My German is terrible, but my sense this weekend when I was in Germany and from reading the newspapers and talking to friends was that they're actually having that conversation, at least in Germany.
No. But that's my point, my comparative point, that conversation is taking place in Germany. But you and I aren't German citizens.
Right.
We don't believe
Putin is talking to Angela Merkel instead of to Barack Obama.
Yeah, but what about our own country?
I mean,
progressives go on and on and on about American democracy, but progressive politicians aren't speaking out. Some of them call me on the phone and say they're worried. And I say, well, Senator, well, Congressperson, you should be worried. Why don't you ask some public questions? Go on a network that's always trying to get you on and say you'd like things to slow down and have a discussion. Not a peep. There's not a profile of courage. Not one. And how in a democracy that can be possible among nearly 600 elected national representatives? I don't know of a governor who's spoken out either. And by the way, people who once ran for the American presidency, I'm thinking of some Democrats, we don't need to name them, who once opposed this policy, they too are silent now.
Well, I'm reminded of, I think of Barbara Lee was the only person in the House who voted against the resolution to go into Iraq or Afghanistan, or the other.
Yes.
I mean, it's like history repeats itself.
It's a lament about American democracy, but it's also an omen of where we're headed, because when there is no resistance at all, the people who probably believe in this crazy policy will pursue it. And I should say not only is there a debate in Germany, but even in the much despised Russian mass media, the Times had a big article last week that the Russian media was full of misinformation and exaggerations. And I said, yes. Now, could you have a line where you said, and some of this also appears in the American media, but you aren't going to read that in the New York Times. Putin has been criticized for his policy toward Ukraine. Not a lot. But he has been criticized, and I will give you an example. The leading Russian, I would say, anti-Putin newspaper, it's called Novaya Gazeta, the new Gazeta, the new newspaper. That's the paper whose correspondents, so many of them, have been assassinated over the years. It's a very democratic newspaper. It has a fairly big circulation, enormous website. They published My Nation article, the one you just mentioned. And they published it, and they said, we have to have a discussion in Russia. At the same time, I can't get on the New York Times op-ed page, and I can give you several people far more eminent than am I, with bigger credentials, but with the same views, who can't get on that page. You can forget the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And as for the talk shows on television, every now and then one of us pops up fleetingly, briefly, but our voices are drowned out, and now you know we're in trouble when they're bringing the generals on to discuss this.
Yes.
As CNN and NBC are now doing, they don't want to talk to civilians anymore. They can sniff a war when they know one. They want the generals. And, of course, the generals have one piece of advice. Their only dispute is whether you send him 175 paratroopers or 175,000 ground troops. That's their only dispute.
Or which type of missile to use. And the other thing that they don't do is they don't disclose that most of these generals who are experts on these, particularly the cable networks, are also employees as consultants or on the board of directors of the large defense corporations.
You asked before what this might mean if this Cold War gets entrenched.
Right.
And I said it's going to be more dangerous, and I'm worried at the moment not about Cold War, because we're in it. We're in it. But about the possibility of hot war with Russia, either via civil war in Ukraine, or somebody kills an American paratrooper in Eastern Europe, or a sniper kills a Russian officer on the borders. And because you know all these mysterious killings are going on, and each side is it's done by guys in black masks, and nobody knows who's really behind it, but each side believes the worst of the other. But, I mean, what we know, even if there's not hot war, is that it's going to mean a lot more military expenditures here, a lot more surveillance, a lot more kind of militant priorities in our budgetary discussions. It's going to mean skewing our educational system to the know thy enemy the way it was for 45 years. But it will be good for some people, as you say. It's good for some businesses, so to speak.
Yes.
But it's
Jackson Brown.
The rest of us, and I've got grandkids, so I'm thinking long term.
Yeah. Now, in my youth, we actually believed there was a possibility that a hot war with Russia meant that a nuclear bomb would land on New York and Detroit, and that ours would land on Moscow and Leningrad. What kind of probability do you assign to that sort of thing?
Here's what I see the worst scenario being, and it's twofold. Our leaders, if they know the truth, and you never know if a president and his or her advisors know the truth and are lying, or just if they're misinformed. I lead toward the misinformed theory, but that's their responsibility for appointing bad advisors.
Right.
One of the things they told us when the Soviet Union ended was that the danger of nuclear war, except for a terrorist act, was gone. Just the opposite was true. The Russian system of command and control was in great shape when the Soviet Union ended. It's been in lousy shape since then. Another number of people have written articles and books about mishaps where the Russians mistook a large seagull on their radar for an incoming missile and practically went to launch, retaliatory launch. So I wouldn't want to stress the Russian system of command and control, which has been badly damaged by nearly 20 years of economic depression and disintegration in Russia.
So in other words, we could have an all-out, full-blown nuclear war by accident.
You know, the thing is, the logical thing to have done, even if you couldn't reduce nuclear weapons, was to take all nuclear weapons off high alert. High alert means that the chain of command has 14 minutes, I will repeat, 14 minutes, to decide whether to launch in retaliation or not. In other words, whether the material, the information they're getting from their radar systems, their satellites, is accurate or not. 14 minutes. It takes my daughter nearly 14 hours to decide which movie she's going to go to. I mean, this is preposterous.
It's
on the razor edge. Nothing should be on high alert.
The
warhead should be taken off so it takes 48 hours or more to put them back on. What's going to happen in those 48 hours? That's the first
thing. Hold that thought, please. We will be back with more of Professor Cohen.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Be sure to check out Stephen Cohen's new piece. It's in TheNation.com. The title is Cold War Again. Who's responsible? We'll be right back. And we're back. We're back on the air. Steve,
can we go to the second nuclear danger here?
Yeah, please.
So the first is accidental, and particularly on the part of the Russians, who are wired to the nth degree and nervous and expecting a stab in the back and are not fully in control.
But we've had situations where, I mean, that plane carried four fully armed nuclear weapons across the United States. We didn't, you know, I mean, we've had our share of screw-ups too, right?
Well, Tom, the fact that they can't find the Malaysian airliner should remind us of the fallibility of our supposedly infallible technology.
Sure.
All right, but But let's go to a more practical scenario. Russians, and this didn't begin with Putin, it evolved under our dear friend Boris Yeltsin, the first president of post-Soviet Russia, have made it absolutely clear in their military doctrine that if they are overrun by the West's superior conventional forces, and the West's forces, conventional forces, that means non-nuclear, are superior, they reserve the right to resort to tactical nuclear weapons. Now, remember what tactical nuclear weapons are. They're sometimes called battlefield nuclear weapons. They can be launched from, you know, hand-carried launchers, from tanks. Anything that can shoot an artillery shell can fire almost anything, a tactical nuclear weapon. Russia has enormous supplies, and it is warned that if they are overrun by conventional forces from the West, they will resort to these.
Now, a tactical nuke does what? It takes out a small city? I mean, how big an explosion is it?
I don't know, but it emits radioactive material in the air and makes the area unlivable
yeah.
in the foreseeable future. Think of it like this. If those airliners that attacked us on 9/11, if those guys had managed to carry a very, very small suitcase-sized tactical nuclear weapon onto those planes, you wouldn't even be able to visit the Twin Towers area today.
Right.
It would be radioactive. Right. So regardless of how many people it would kill from the blast, it would make the area unlivable, a large area. So you're in a situation now where the Russians are very nervous. They see us coming at them, paratroopers landing, Joe Biden in Kiev, the head of the CIA, for God's sake, 2 weeks ago Sunday, sitting in Kiev. What was he doing there? They see threats. They see an American-run threat. Are they paranoid? Well, the answer is Delmore Schwartz, the famous poet. Even paranoids have enemies.
Right.
I mean, Russia does have enemies.
I mean, how would we respond if the head of the it's not called the KGB anymore, but whatever it is, and President Putin were visiting with Fidel Castro? Or
well, what if they showed up at Occupy Wall Street? That would be the equivalent. McCain went to the demonstrations in Kiev.
Yeah.
Victoria Nuland, the top State Department official, went there, and we heard her on the phone plotting a coup.
And I understand she's married to Kagan, the neocon?
Yeah, but I don't do spousal associations. They're complicated. But
okay.
She is. Yeah, she's married to Robert Kagan. She is herself a neocon,
right.
a philosophical outlook. But, I mean, if you know, we say the Russians are intervening in Ukraine. Now, looking from the Russian point of view, McCain and who's that Democratic senator from Connecticut?
Lieberman.
No, Lieberman's gone.
Oh.
His replacement, the younger guy.
Yeah. So Blumenthal, is it?
He went with, no.
No, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
But he went with McCain, so
yeah.
It was bipartisan.
Oh, my.
And Joe Biden shows up in Kiev, and before that, the head of the CIA. Now, what if the vice president of Russia, Medvedev, let's say, the prime minister, came to the United States to sit down with Occupy Wall Street?
Go nuts.
We would have long since launched.
Yeah, we would have gone totally, totally nuts. Professor Stephen Cohen with us. We'll be right back with more of Professor Cohen. Welcome back, Dennis. Before the hour, the article dated April 1st, the most recent article in TheNation.com by Stephen F. Cohen, Cold War Again, Who's Responsible? Professor Cohen, Professor Emeritus at New York University in Princeton, and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, from Stalinism to the New Cold War, as well as this new article, Cold War Again, Who's Responsible? One of the conversational threads that we began as we were ending the first half hour, because we just have about 7 minutes here left, and I want to get back to this, is motivational. You suggested that the common storylines of what's driving Mr. Putin are wrong, and I have no idea what the motive of Mr. Obama is. Your thoughts on these?
Well, it's an important point. If you look at the American media today, and I just will give you two examples, which I found in the newspaper and in a magazine yesterday, I mean the mainstream American print media and the broadcast media. One of two motivations are said to be behind, quote, Putin's aggressive policies toward Ukraine. I actually don't think they're very aggressive. I think they're pushback. I mean, you could ask, was he reactive to something we did beginning in November or longer before? Or did he start this? He clearly didn't start this, and he clearly didn't want it. But what's animating him now? And the two explanations are, I think, either false or very partial. One is that he's trying to restore the Soviet Union because he once said it was a terrible event. He didn't actually say exactly what he's quoted as saying, but never mind. He did say it was a catastrophe, which, by the way, it was for millions of people who lived in that area. In fact, Ukraine is part of the fallout of the end of the Soviet Union, and it is becoming catastrophic. The second reason given for Putin's, quote, aggressive policies toward Ukraine is that he's weak at home, and he has to shore up his popular support at home. And then you get a flip to the old Western scenario, that when a Western leader is weak, a little war comes in handy.
Yeah.
These are the two explanations.
Reagan and Grenada.
But, you know, it's been around political, you know, strategists, as they call themselves for some reason now, that a little war could always help an unpopular leader in any country. About the Soviet Union, Putin once said the following. He didn't originate it, but I think it's the way maybe 65% of Russians feel. Anyone who does not regret the end of the Soviet Union has no heart. Anyone who thinks we can rebuild the Soviet Union has no head. I think that pretty much is the Russian point of view. Why has no heart? Because Putin and his generation, and quite a few others, were born in the Soviet Union. They grew up. They got their education. They found their first job. They had sex for the first time. They fell in love. They got married. They raised their kids. They made their careers. That's their biography, their autobiography. Of course you regret loss of your biography. Any people would. Why can it not be rebuilt? Because there would be no point in doing it. All those republics were mainly a burden on Russia, draining its resources. Secondly, that's not even the geopolitical concern of Russia. So now we come to what Putin's real motivation is. He doesn't want to rebuild the Soviet Union, but he doesn't want to lose to NATO, to the West, Russia's traditional national security zones. And they are twofold. Georgia in the south, which is the road to the Caucasus, and you know the Caucasus is where many of Russia's 15 million or more, 25 million, I think, Muslim Islamic citizens live. It's a multicultural society. To have that open to a NATO base or to political movement by the West in that underbelly of Russia would be a catastrophe. Anybody, in any American journal could tell you that was so. That's why they're so eager to get there. But above all, Ukraine. For historical, cultural reasons. But remember, we're all upset that Putin annexed, or as Putin would say, reunited Crimea. What was Crimea? It was the Russian deep-sea naval base. And they believed, Moscow, that the plan coming from the West that they had witnessed in Ukraine since November was to take over the entirety of Ukraine, including Crimea. And that if they didn't bring it into the Russian Federation now, tomorrow might be too late. Now, you can say what a crazy notion the Russians had. But then you got to back up and ask, did we do anything to put that crazy notion in their head? And if we did, then the people who did that on our side are responsible for the crisis we're now in. End of story. But there is nobody in the United States who wants to ask this question or analyze it. I will give you one example. Back in November, it was said, when the European Union offered Ukraine this agreement to become a prosperous democratic member of the European market, that was a benign offer, and Putin and the Ukrainian leadership rejected it. It is not true. First of all, Europe told Ukraine it had to choose between Russia and the West. Why? Why? Russia was prepared to give aid to Ukraine, financial aid, along with the West. That was rejected. But if you read the agreement, which is 1,000 pages long, Title 7 and Title 9 are called security issues. And though NATO is not mentioned, it makes it very clear that by signing this benign democratic economic agreement, Ukraine would oblige itself to follow the military and security policies of Europe, of the European Union. What are those policies? It's called NATO.
Right.
And it houses in Brussels. The Russians can read.
Yeah, yeah. And they would be, just from a security point of view, they'd be crazy to go along with it. But Professor Cohen, Steve, thank you so much for your insights and your brilliant writing and for being on the program.
Time when there's some good news.
Yeah, yeah, let's hope so.
But there may never be again.
Yeah, well, we'll keep talking. Professor Stephen Cohen, thank you. You can read it over at The Nation, Cold War Again, Who's Responsible, thenation.com. And, of course, his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the new Cold War. Highly recommended all. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.